You are now listening to the eWatchman Podcast with your host, Robert Cade.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Watchman's Post Podcast. This program was recorded for, let's call it, the third week of January in the new year, 2015. My apologies for missing the December installment of this podcast. Believe me, I made a mighty effort, but came up short. A number of things factored into that, but I'm happy to be speaking to you now. What do we have here on the internet? What's it, Jamie Dimon says the banks are under assault? That headline caught my eye there. I was checking the financials for today, but that's a pretty amazing statement. It's the banks that are actually the leading edge of the empire's assault on the nation states. And I think we're going to see the culmination of that in the next few months as it's appearing now, as things are shaping up. Definitely going to be an interesting year. You know, Americans are all giddy that, you know, the price of oil is going down. It's so much cheaper to fill up my gas tank. Well, there's a lot more to it than that, isn't there? It's an assault upon, really, the whole entire system. It's the takedown of the system because, well, I won't get into it here, but so much of the financial system is tied to energy and derivatives contracts written to oil producers. And so it is going to result in numerous bankruptcies and the upsetting of trillions of dollars of derivatives, and with the intent of bringing down the system. And I would say it's an indication that it's time for the beginning of the end. Well, I have a number of questions here, some old and some new. This was intended for the mailbag program in December, but that didn't happen. So let's consider it now. He quotes from the letter of James, where it says, "When under trial, let no one say, 'I am being tried by God.' For with evil things God cannot be tried, nor does he himself try anyone." So he says, it clearly states that God does not try us with evil. But at Matthew 4:1, we see that Jesus was led by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And then again, Revelation 20, where it says, as soon as the 1,000 years had ended, Satan will be released from his prison, and he will go out to mislead those nations in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together for the war. So his question is not Jesus tried with Satan, the father of evil itself? Or will not Satan's being released from prison to test mankind at the end of the 1,000-year rule? Then how can James 1:13 states that God does not try us with evil? My doubt is how these seemingly contradictory scriptures must be understood. Your reply is much awaited. Well, thank you for your patience. Well, there is a difference. God does not try us with evil. And the way we understand that, consider what happened with the man Job. It's a seemingly unimportant book in the Bible, but it reveals some very vital information about this issue between Satan and Jehovah. And as you know, Job was singled out as a blameless and upright man who feared God and turned aside from bad. And Satan's contention was that he just did that because God blessed him and God put a, you know, a protective hedge around him. And that Job, you know, if he were really pressed, he would turn against God. And Satan brought this up in front of all of Jehovah's heavenly court. Very serious accusation. He's basically impugning the character and integrity of all of God's intelligent creation. That we will not worship God out of love and loyalty to him. That when push comes to shove, we'll do what's in our own interests. And so God allowed Satan to test Job. He said, look, he's in your hand, only against his soul, his life itself. Do not thrust out your hand. Because he knew Job could stand up to it. And Jehovah's intent on settling this issue. And we should be glad that he does, because he's intent on shutting the mouth of Satan and anyone who has his viewpoint and putting an end to him. Now, in the case of Jesus, and in the case of those at the end of the 1,000 years, there is a distinction between Jesus and them and the man Job. And what is that? Jesus was perfect. And so will those be at the end of the 1,000 years. But yes, the scriptures say that the Spirit led Jesus into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. Because again, Jehovah wants to settle this issue. Satan could have argued, well, this man Job, he's this, you know, he's an imperfect man. He's a stubborn. You know, give me a perfect man. I'll show you. I'll break him. And so it began when Jesus, as soon as he was baptized and presented as the Messiah, then the Spirit led him off to be tempted by the devil. That was just the beginning. And of course, the scripture says that the devil left him until another convenient time. And when it came to the final days of Jesus' ministry, Jehovah took his protective spirit away entirely. Again, why? To settle the issue. And Jehovah took his spirit away completely when Jesus was executed. Jesus was alone for that moment. He'd never been without the closeness of his Father. And that's why his final words were, "My God, my God, why have you left me?" But he accomplished Jehovah's will and basically sealed the devil's doom. Of course, we also have to prove our integrity, but for the most part, the issue is settled. But I would hope that answers the question. Jehovah wants to settle the issue, and we have to weigh in and prove that we're not like the devil said we are, that we will love God no matter what. And we won't, you know, skin on behalf of skin, everything a man has, he'll give on behalf of his soul. We won't do anything just to save our own neck, you know. It's a privilege, isn't it? It's basically what it means to be one of Jehovah's Witnesses. We are witnesses in the sense that we are advocates of God's sovereignty, and we're willing to suffer for it. Paul said that, I think it was to the Philippians, you have the privilege of suffering for Christ, because Christ suffered to settle this issue. Okay, this next question I think is from the same questioner. It's rather lengthy, so I'll try to condense it down here. But he says, I'm having difficulty in believing in everlasting life. He said, because after giving more thought, I literally got a headache and had to pop a couple of pills. He says, I do believe that nature is created by Jehovah God because of its orderliness, from what I see. But when the matter of living without end arises, some kind of doubt comes into my mind when compared to the life cycle of a star. And he says that... He goes on here, and he gives me a link to a YouTube video, which was actually a National Geographic video about the sun and the life cycle of stars and how eventually all the hydrogen fuel is expended and the star goes into a death cycle. It expands. Our sun, for example, has the potential to expand and take up the entire solar system, engulfing all the planets therein, including the Earth. And that would be, of course, the end of life as we know it here on this planet. So he's asking me to solve this perplexity in his mind. Well, you know, as we know, the Bible is not a book of science. God doesn't go into detail explaining how he did everything. We couldn't understand it if he did, could we? Really? But it does make brief and to-the-point comments. For example, scientists have come to understand that the universe had a beginning, that all of the matter that we see that makes up the stars and the galaxies and everything down to the little molecules that make up everything, including ourselves, it had a beginning. And what does the Bible say in the opening words? In the beginning. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So scientists have confirmed what the Bible said, that the universe had a beginning. It didn't have to be that way. Scientists at one time thought maybe things have always been here, but now they know it had a beginning. Well, did God create this vast universe to function independently of his control, you might say? And apparently the answer is, again, no. And amazingly, the scriptures do touch on this. I won't read the verses, but in Hebrews, the first chapter, Paul was quoting from the 102nd Psalm, and he was contrasting God's eternity with the transitoriness of the universe. And he said, "You, O God, are from everlasting, and your days will never run out, but the heavens will wear out. And you will change them like a garment." So again, basically, science is confirming what the Bible has said, that the universe will wear out. But does that mean it's going to revert back to nothingness or come apart? No. The scripture says it will be changed, like you have a garment that wears out and you change it, and you put on a new garment. So again, God is, he couldn't begin to explain to us what he's going to do. But we can take his word for it, can't we? That he will sustain his creation and make whatever necessary changes are in order. It's funny, my wife, developed an interest in physics and astronomy some years ago and read she read Albert Einstein's theory of creativity. I don't know what got into her, but I remember she said to me one time, I mean, she was really upset with this too, like the questioner, what are we going to do? The sun's going to run out of helium or whatever. And she goes, "Well, you remember when you get into your kingdom to, pump some more hydrogen, helium into the sun?" Oh. I told her, you're talking to a guy that sometimes forgets to put the trash out on the curb on pickup day, so I don't know. No, but seriously. We can trust Jehovah, I think. He says that the earth will always be here. He didn't create it simply for nothing, and that people will live forever. And I think we can trust Jehovah to do what is necessary to keep the whole thing going. Like Jesus said, is anything impossible with God? But thank you for your question. I appreciate it. Okay, I have a series of three questions here from a questioner regarding basically the Watchtower's feeling about independent study. Why do you feel Charles Russell stated that if anyone read the Bible alone, without the study volumes he wrote, that within 2 weeks a Christian would fall into spiritual darkness. Well, that's a pretty bold statement, I would think. 2 weeks is a pretty short period of time, but probably from his perspective, it took a concerted effort for them, really, to break free from the long-standing errors of the churches. And he probably saw from firsthand experience that people that seemed to break away would relapse and go back to the churches, to what was comfortable for them. Perhaps they didn't want to be, you know, persecuted as, you know, being out of step with the mainstream. But I don't have a problem with that. Well, let's consider his second question here, because it's very similar. So why did the Watchtower in 1981, August 15th, page 25, paragraph 14, say that those developing an independent attitude or who were reading the Bible alone, etc., are from Satan? Well, again, I think probably from their experience. 1981, that was about the time Ray Franz and some others, they had started independent Bible studies at Bethel and came up with some things that spread like wildfire, like Paul said, gangrene. And, you know, the Watchtower came down pretty heavy on that movement. Of course, Ray Franz was later disfellowshipped, and some others at Bethel were as well. But I, you know, I tend to agree with the Watchtower. I've read a lot of this stuff. I've read Ray Franz's books. I can't see that he added anything useful. He was basically a fault finder. That's pretty easy to do, really. I mean, he came up with this thing that Jesus is not just the mediator for the 104. That's just nonsense. Jesus is the mediator of a new covenant, and the new covenant encompasses those who belong to Christ. It's pretty simple. But if that's what his independent study led him to, then I think the Watchtower is absolutely right on. So look, Satan, he plays both sides of this thing, doesn't he? He tries to get people separated from an organization that Christ is using, but at the same time, he is allowed to infiltrate that organization because he knows it is Jehovah's organization, as they say, Christ's congregation. So I really don't see that anyone outside of the Watchtower has added anything to our knowledge that's worth knowing. And if you think I'm being hypocritical, I would clarify that I'm not outside the Watchtower. Am I? I mean, obviously I didn't learn what I've learned as regards prophecy from the Watchtower, but that's only partially true. I mean, that laid the foundation for the knowledge that I was later privy to. And it pertains to the faith of Jehovah's Witnesses. Okay, now the third question is similar. He says, if Jehovah is not blessing the governing body or the Watchtower, how is he feeding his sheep? And how do we factor in Jesus being in control of the congregation? For instance, the seven congregations of Revelation. Is that not a worthy argument that Jesus surely is in control of things out of regard for his sheep? Well, I believe that Jesus is in control. And I do believe the Watchtower teaches the basic truth, the truth that will allow us to have a functioning relationship with Jehovah and do his will up to this point. But consider those seven congregations of Revelation. I mean, the Watchtower, they have to finagle it a little bit and say that those seven congregations represent all of Christendom. And yet, according to the account there in Revelation, those seven congregations are like seven stars in Jesus' hand. And they are in existence during the day of the Lord. Now, the Watchtower says that all of true Christians have gotten out of Christendom by the time the day of the Lord began. They say the day of the Lord began in 1914 anyway. So that's all a mess. The point is, in those seven congregations are individuals who do not have Christ's approval. For example, Jesus referred twice to the sect of Nicolaus, and he said, I have hated the sect of Nicolaus. Maybe Nicolaus was involved in reading the Bible alone, right? But then there is this faction of Balaam within Jesus' seven congregations. And there's also Jezebel. If you remember Balaam, he was a prophet of God. He had several conversations with God. And yet then he counseled King Balak on how to ensnare the Israelites in idolatry and fornication, knowing that Jehovah would punish them according to the law that he'd given them. So we have that sort of influence within Christ's congregation. Consider, for example, the Watchtower's policy towards child abuse. Their obligation is to protect and defend the helpless and the vulnerable. That's the underlying foundation of true Christianity. And you might say they have repudiated Christianity. They have made abused children their legal adversaries. Who else could be behind that but Satan the devil and this Balaam-like advisor to their legal department? And they have most surely brought the organization into a situation that will require Jehovah's judgment and severe punishment, particularly upon the leadership, just as Balaam brought that upon the Israelites. So that's a hard thing, I think, for some people to keep fixed in their mind. It's a paradox. How could it be Jehovah's organization? How could it be the truth when we have all this mountain of wrongdoing and lies, really, according to the Watchtower's 1914 hoax? But anyway, I won't go into that, but there's enough written on that on the Watchman's Post. I am sorry, friends, but I know I missed last month, but I am really pressed for time today. I'm going to keep moving here, and I hope to do more frequent podcasts and certainly not miss a month, but okay. I just got this question in the other day. Many people, particularly proponents of so-called end times eschatology, claim that the expression, the conclusion of the system of things, as rendered by the New World Translation, is misleading. And they argue that the correct translation should be the end of the world. Can you explain why the Watchtower's, why the New World Translation's rendering is correct? Well, I would say that really they're both correct, depending on how we understand the word world, right? I mean, the world is going to end if we consider that the world is the present civilization. So there's really not much difference between the system of things and the world if we understand the world to mean the world of mankind, the political system, the religious system, what makes up a system of things. Now, it's unfortunate, but people, when they hear that expression, the end of the world, they've been conditioned to think that it's the end of the earth. And that's not even what the word world literally means. It's taken from the Greek word cosmos. We understand that to mean the whole world or the universe, but the real definition of the word cosmos is surface. It's where our word cosmetics comes from, something you put on the surface of your skin, for example. So the cosmos in that strict sense, is what is on the earth, inhabiting the earth, the world of mankind. So, well, even the Bible, though, it says that the earth is going to be destroyed, but is that to be taken literally? Well, no, of course not. There's going to be a new heavens and a new earth. God is not going to destroy the heavens, the starry heavens. No, we already discussed that. He's not going to destroy the heavens where he resides. It's going to be a new order, a new way of doing things. People think, well, okay, yeah, there's going to be a new earth. Well, consider what it says of Revelation, the 21st chapter, verses 1 through 4. The new Jerusalem comes down, and God spreads his tent over mankind, right? And he'll wipe out every tear from their eyes, and death and mourning and outcry will be no more. If people think that, and it says this, new, all things have passed away, I'm making all things new. Are people really so unreasonable to think that God's going to create a new planet and then transport people from this planet in their imperfect condition, suffering, you know, mourning, outcry, and pain, and all of that, and transfer them to another planet and then heal them there? And this is silly. It's silly. People just believe any sort of nonsensical thing because they can't believe the truth. Really, Satan won't let them because they don't want to know. But really, I wouldn't quibble about the end of the system or the end of the world as long as we define what we mean by the world. Now, in the Greek, there was a word, centilia. That's what the Watchtower translated as a conclusion of the system of things. In other translations, the end of the age or the end of the world. The end of the order, whatever. That word centilia was used by the translators of the Septuagint, which was the first translation of the Hebrew into another language, which in this case was Greek. And in the book of Daniel, that expression in the New World Translation is the time of the end. And virtually every translation uses that same expression, the time of the end. But when the 70 men who translated the Septuagint, they used the word centilia in Greek to express time of the end. So there's no connotation of a world or a system of things there. It's the time of the end of the human system of things, because that's the whole theme of the book of Daniel, that the human political system reaches an end and it is crushed and replaced by the Prince of Princes, the Son of Man, and Michael the Great Prince, however he expresses it in a different way. God's kingdom replaces this system of things, this world. Okay, this is interesting. They ask, what do you think of the Watchtower's explanation of the daily text for January 15? I'll read that text for you. The verse is taken from Matthew 13:43. It says, at that time, the righteous ones will shine as brightly as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. The phrase, at that time, evidently refers to the event that Jesus had just mentioned, namely the pitching of the weeds into the fiery furnace. That occurs during the final part of the Great Tribulation. Thus, the shining brightly of the anointed must occur at that future time as well. Jesus also said that the righteous ones will shine in the kingdom. What does that mean? All faithful anointed ones who are still on earth after the initial part of the Great Tribulation has passed will already have received their final sealing. Then, as indicated in Jesus' prophecy about the Great Tribulation, they will be gathered to heaven. There, they will shine in the kingdom of their Father, and shortly after the Battle of Armageddon, they will share as Jesus' joyous bride and the marriage of the Lamb. Well, they don't have it quite right. How do we know? Well, Jesus referred to his kingdom twice in his parable of the wheat and the weeds. The righteous will shine in the kingdom of their Father, but before that, there's a preliminary judgment that occurs. Jesus said he would send out his angels and they will gather out from his kingdom all persons doing lawlessness and all things causing stumbling. Out from his kingdom. Is that the heavenly kingdom? Well, the demons have been in God's heaven, as mentioned there in Job. Surely they will be cleared out, but that's not the kingdom Jesus is referring to that has stumbling blocks and persons doing lawlessness. That kingdom is Christ's congregation. That's the kingdom Paul was referring to when he wrote to the Colossians and said, "You've been called out of darkness and have been transferred into the kingdom of the Son of his love." So before Christ's kingdom begins ruling, those who are part of this bride, as the text mentioned, who are going to rule with Christ, who have been called to that anyway, if they're faithful, they are in his kingdom, in the sense they are in his congregation, and he is their king. So, after the angels clear out all persons doing lawlessness and all things causing stumbling, then we have what the Watchtower calls a spiritual paradise. The complete absence of evil. No evil persons will be allowed in this congregation that Jehovah is preparing for entry into the new world, into the new heavens and the new earth. But this congregation specifically refers to those who are ruling with Christ, who are called to the kingdom. So they will begin to shine as brightly as the sun in the kingdom of their Father while they are on the earth. During that judgment period, that's when Jehovah's Spirit will be poured out upon his sons and his daughters, as it mentions in Job. That's the anointed. They're already anointed. It's unlike in the first century when they were anointed with the Holy Spirit. The sons, and they're already sons and daughters, but they're given the full portion of God's Spirit, and their minds and hearts are opened up completely. And that is when they will shine as brightly as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. And that's what will bring about the king of the north hearing reports that terrify him from the rising of the sun. Right? Revelation speaks of the kings from the rising of the sun. Once Jehovah pours his Spirit out upon them and they become as these indomitable spiritual forces like Samson, then at the king of the north will exterminate them. And that will bring about God's judgment because it will be a direct attack upon the kingdom by putting to death the kings of that kingdom. So the Watchtower, I mean, they're inching toward the truth. They used to say that the righteous ones began shining as brightly as the sun from the 1919 onward, you know. But they've revised it. They still say, though, that the harvest began in 1914, blah, blah, blah. It's just ridiculous. I don't want to hold it up to any more ridicule than I already have, but, you know, most of you probably read the chapter in Jehovah's Become King, the harvest and her spiritual paradise. So, but I think we're close to this beginning of the harvest. And that's what we're looking at. Well, I think that's going to do it for us, friends. Thank you for listening. And as I say, I'll try to do another program soon enough. Until then, may Jehovah bless your search for the truth.